I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
I chose this because of the title of Laura's book, because of the idea of freedom, which I think is something we both talk about a bit in our books, Freedom and Movement, and the ways that women can inhabit these spaces or these opportunities. So this is from my Paris chapter. My book follows a woman around Europe as she travels in order to kind of rid herself of a unsuccessful relationship, which took place mostly in the non-space of online. So this is Paris in Belleville. Beyond the Maison, in a dip behind the Parc de Belleville, I walk down the steps into the Place Henri Krasicki, named the resistance fighter and trade unionist, where a woman is selling the communist paper L'Humanité. Others are in polite discussion. On a wall in the neighboring Rue Lévert, graffiti, Peuple de France, prends ta liberté. People of France, claim your freedom. Liberty, freedom, to walk where we choose, to choose where we walk. Freedom to cross the hexagonal crossroads in the Place Henri Krasicki, which, like most Parisian junctions, offers six, not four, alternatives. The Rue Lévert, Rue de la Mar, Rue de Cascade, Rue de Couronne, Rue de la Mer again, continuing on the other side, the Rue des Envierges, or freedom not to cross, to stay. But freedom is movement, isn't it? L'air n'a pas de frontières, online neither. Isn't she lovely? Is that you? Your voice, which is now part of my head. You said before you went away, I'll see you in Prague if we're still writing. But we're not writing, so how can you be talking to me? Isn't she lovely? Do you mean L'Humanité vendor? Every Parisian is a street walker. In a city of tiny flats, women dress to be seen from the pavement. The L'Humanité vendor walks into the Place Henri Krasicki, like me, from the Rue des Envierges, the street of the bevergent. Alternative meanings, the street of the becleaned, be emptied, be unsullied. The clothes she wears are street clothes, not a Chanel jacket. I never saw a Parisian in Chanel jacket. But in Belleville, jeans, a black perfecto unzipped, a floral scarf. Isn't she lovely? Of course she is. I see it now. I saw women for the first time through your eyes, the way men see them. A flash of leg, a curve of breast, never the full woman. You saw them from the side, from behind, always walking away, a flick of scarf, a toss of hair, a glance. You saw the finish, the edge as it drops boundaryless into nothing from the corner of your eye. In Paris, where the crossroads are hexagonal, not four-pronged, there are more corners, and you had an eye for them. Isn't she lovely? Even if she's not, some part of her always is. Choose, and you'll never be satisfied. The one with the legs won't be the one with the breasts, and so on, and etc. Isn't she lovely? How can I tell? Lost in a forest of 100 breasts, 100 legs. Isn't she lovely? Of course she are. They're crossing the road in front of me, the Parisians, in the Place Henri Krasicki. They choose their directions at the crossroads. It's an illusion. Their choice of streets is no wider than mine. They cannot choose to be older, less lovely, just as I cannot choose to be younger or more so. They may have more time, but they have no more control over their time than I do. They are at a point along the line. They can choose only to move forwards. They cannot choose to skip time, though they presumably have more of it to come. They cannot choose not to move or go back. For each pedestrian, there is no more than one way out. I cross the road to the rond-point of the Place Henri Krasicki.
Thanks, Joanna. And so, Lara, if you'd like to read from the first extract.
So I'm going to read the opening of the book, which is called Lessons from Lessing. There were too many weddings that summer. White weddings, gold weddings, weddings in village churches, on beaches, at woolen mills. Collectively, they seemed to go on for too long and to involve too much effort. Whether it was the effort of the congregation to reach these much-loved remote places, or the effort of the bride and groom to coordinate flowers, music, seating plans, personalised vows, homemade confetti, and take-home marmalade. At all of them, I chastised myself for my own mean-spiritedness and hypocrisy. I too am married and once devoted a summer to it, but determined that at some point when not at a wedding, I would work out why I minded it all so much. I came closer to understanding my own truculence when I attended the wedding of a school friend while halfway through reading The Golden Notebook, Doris Lessing's 1962 exploration of the artistic and sexual life of a free woman. Lessing's voice is powerful and it had taken hold of me 50 years later, to the extent that it seemed to muffle the voices around me. I could hear her sentences in my ears as I sat below 100 metres of tasteful liberty print bunting that the bride, her sister and their mother, three intelligent and expensively educated women, had sewn by hand. Troubled by the mental picture of a needle threaded, pulled through and along the fabric, back through, in again, back through, ad infinitum, I heard Lessing's central character Anna Wolfe's pronouncement. I am interested only in stretching myself, in living as fully as I can. For Anna, living fully means living freely. She has been married and is prepared to marry again, but she's aware of the fragility of any relationship because love experienced authentically is dangerous. And she remains uncertain whether she's willing to allow a sexual relationship to define her place in the world. Thinking about her, I realized that my main objection to these weddings wasn't a feminist one. I was certainly troubled by the ease with which we perpetuated the symbolism of the pallidly virginal bride being handed from one man to another, and perturbed in this case that it was the women who'd done all that sewing. But it wouldn't have been much better if the groom had taken up needlework as well. What I minded more strongly was the apparent assumption that this remained the only way to live. Weddings celebrated on this scale seemed to take for granted a happy ever after of decade after decade of safely monogamous marriage, with appropriate numbers of children born at appropriate intervals along the way. They ushered in a world where work was a means to the ultimate end of enjoyable family life, where love was the love you at the end of a phone call. I felt uncomfortable partly because it seemed to co-opt everyone in the room into this vision, and this made me claustrophobic, needing urgently to insist on my right to live fully without quite knowing what I would want that to entail. Sitting under that tasteful bunting, I was talking to two school friends at a table that had been emptied as people headed towards the dance floor. I asked them what they felt about this industrious celebration of love and was relieved to find that they were sceptical too, though one of them was preparing to get married a few months later and was even, occasioning more irritation on my part, planning to change her name. We were all aware that this was not what we'd had in mind when we read Virginia Woolf and D.H. Lawrence in adolescence, aware that we'd once thought of love as something freer and more radical. We remembered an evening during the summer of our A-levels when the three of us had lain talking and drinking on the grass of one of their gardens, and as the sky darkened, each had confessed, to the surprise of the others, that we were still virgins. We'd all had boyfriends, but we'd assumed an old-fashioned coyness in delaying the moment of deflowerment, partly out of fear and partly out of a reluctance to relinquish the independence of self-sufficiency, though I'm not sure we would have defined it so coolly at the time. Reared at a school where we'd been taught that girls could do everything and had no need of boys, we felt that there'd be an element of self-betrayal involved in entering a state where we became dependent on the desire, approval, and companionship of men. As the band began to play in the adjoining room, I told them about The Golden Notebook, about Anna Wolfe, who, like us, was in her mid-30s, and her struggle to live as honestly as possible.
I described what I saw as Lessing's central dilemma, and how it had helped me to see in retrospect what it was that we had feared would be lost once we had succumbed to a life of sex with men. Anna wants to be free, believes that she cannot thrive as a writer or a woman if she does not exist independently of her lovers. But she cannot be happy without the love of a man, and she cannot love fully unless she relinquishes control enough to lose herself in him. Sexually, she wants to be created by his desire, to have the pleasurably overwhelming feeling of experiencing his body as hers. Emotionally, she wants both to depend on him and to be needed by him, so that together they can feel the vulnerability required to be transfigured by love. She's aware that the price for this transfiguration could be a loss of freedom. Indeed, she's prepared to accept that it might lead her to marry for a second time. Now, thinking about Anna as we rose to join the dancing, I thought that there might not be anything wrong with her acceptance of this, but that it was possible still to remember that it was a high price to pay even while paying it, and that this required an ambivalence that seemed incompatible with all those meters of bunting.
Thank you. Start with a big stuff. It seems to me that we've already started talking about freedom. I mean, the word liberty is in the title of tonight's event, and it seems that we're already talking about the ways that for women, love and sex and desire pose a kind of risk or a limit to that freedom. But when thinking about freedom, I have to confess I'm really not sure what the word means. I'm not sure what we mean when we talk about freedom or about liberty. But I think that's okay, because I think these books aren't sure either. It seems to me that in these books, both of you move through various kind of unstable definitions and experiments and enactments of freedom. And so I wonder if we can start by talking about some of those.
As much as the word freedom, the word that my book examines is the word love, and in a very linguistic way, it's very interested in the range of meanings that it can have,
yeah,
and the range of meanings that it can't have, and the ways that it is put to use. And so, I think that's probably the central role. I'm not sure whether the character in my book, which admittedly is autofictional, is very related to these. Started work as essays, so it's very related to some experiences I have had, but is a novel. The word freedom is less often mentioned, which is interesting. She does do a lot of free things. She does quite happily. I was actually doing an interview about this book with Kay Mitchell in Manchester a couple of weeks ago, and She said, is it specifically about a woman who has been married, because the woman in this book has been married, and who is not looking for that kind of relationship again, who is like Anna Wolf, but is looking for a kind of love, and has decided that she is not going to get this through marriage, though she is willing to surrender to other kinds of bonds, and indeed has. And the problem being that digitally these bonds cannot be broken so easily as they could before the internet age. Mm-hmm.
The word freedom. I mean, part of what drew me to it was that Lessing used it so often, and I felt like she might know what it meant, but I gradually felt like she, that it eluded her grasp as soon as she sort of started getting towards a place where she might feel free, and certainly I felt that. I mean, that opening passage which I read started from, I think, quite a naive moment in a way, in which I thought that I would try out freedom and see what it felt like, but certainly I found that the word sort of lost meaning except as a kind of transitional state towards something freer. It felt like you were never going to sort of attain freedom except in the process of becoming, maybe. And we could talk, I think if we talk about sort of writing itself later, it felt to me like if anything made her feel free and I suppose made me feel free, it was in writing, which is also a sort of transitional state. I mean, reading your book, I did feel like what was being sought by the character was quite similar in a way to what I was defining as freedom through Lessing.
Yeah.
But I can also see why, if you didn't start with a word, it's kind of not a word that you necessarily end up with, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. It's just interesting that it didn't use the word.
I mean, I think it's become quite a problematic word for our generation as well, and that's part of what I liked about Lessing was that she used it with such abandon about communism, about things that we really couldn't, that politics and the way that freedom has been co-opted by every side in every ideological conflict has made it a much harder word to use politically, and then it becomes harder to sort of reclaim it personally as well. And I suppose part of what I was interested in was whether it is possible to reclaim it, because it still does mean something instinctive to us.
Well, certainly the character in my book has a lot of personal freedom if she chooses to take it, but then she has to, you know, like Anna, she has to sacrifice certain emotional props in order to do that, and you know that doesn't seem to have changed that much.
No,
because I mean, I think another thing that perhaps unites both of your books is that freedom or a version of it, however ambivalent or partial we feel about it, seems to come at a kind of cost in both cases. Mm-hmm. And you know the props that you discard. I think loneliness is one of the themes of both of you are writing about states of loneliness and solitude and feeling like a square peg, right?
Yes. Well, the narrator sees a lot of couples and a lot of women in the books, and she's always looking in throughout the book, and she's always looking for clues as to how to be. Mm. And mostly she doesn't find anything that either in couples or occasionally in single women, but most often when she sees couples as she's travelling around, she doesn't see a model which she would like to imitate in any way.
I really liked your descriptions of couples.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Jane Grace, the shared snacks and the rucksack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which could be lovely. I mean, you know, the narrator is obviously talking from a kind of slightly jaded position. Yeah. But she certainly doesn't see a future in that she would like to partake of.
But I think what's good about these scenes, and certainly what I found in Essing and sort of experienced myself, is that it's that neither side ever works, and it's kind of tackling that ambivalence that you never quite want to give up on the idea of the snacks within a whole different relationship that might make them possible.
Because you don't quite give up on it. I think what do you say at the end? I think you describe it as the tyranny of the dominant notion of family life, and I think there's a kind of I think it's fair to say a really profoundly critical view of these kind of conventional ways of doing coupling and relationships and family life. But towards the end in Suffolk, Lara, you seem to find another way of doing things that still involves family and involves relationships, but involves remaking them in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think often it's the word, I find the word family a really hard word. Mm. But a lot of what it entails is about loving your children and spending time with them. It's a sort of fairly straightforward thing to do. And so, much like the word couple, I suppose.
I mean, yes, and husband, I love this, that kind of, you know, that she never wanted to use it because it sort of snaps back like a rubber band. It always feels a strange thing. Also, I write about naming in general. I'm very interested in Denise Riley, poet who lives and professor at Norwich, who has... I think I included a little quote from her about the violence of naming, the violence of defining, and the limitations that this puts on. And it's very difficult when, of course, you're writing a book in words to say that there is something very violent about defining something, about putting a name, giving a name to something that puts boundaries to it.
But that becomes, in a way, the challenge, like the challenge of writing in a framework that sets that up is to somehow keep the ambivalence going to the extent that you never quite define either position. That itself, I suppose, is a form of freedom not to quite decide.
Yes, that tension and the betweenness. I talk a lot about betweenness as well in various ways and in maths as well. And also it's to do with a train journey, or mostly train, you know, occasionally other forms of transport. So there's this kind of feeling of never settling.
And talking of never settling, segue, I wanted to ask about, we've touched upon these things about being in between and kind of ambiguity and not naming something. And both your books follow that formally, in a sense, because they're both really, really properly hybrid works. I mean, Lara, yours is kind of a work of scholarship, a scholarly work, but it's also a work of literary criticism, but it's also memoir and biography as well. And Joanna, you've talked about how yours is a kind of, you know, touches on the memoir in a way, but is very definitely a novel, but it's also essayistic in lots of ways.
Yes.
And is a kind of disquisition on the digital, but also like Europe and all kinds of other things. And I wondered whether how those what the kind of hybrid forms had come about, whether they'd happened quite naturally, whether that was what you planned, whether that had come out of the content or the experience of writing.
Well, I certainly, in writing what can be called a novel, I have a real beef with the idea that in novels, people aren't allowed to discuss things directly. It happens very rarely in novels. I mean, sometimes characters in novels, you know, discuss what they're reading or ideas that they've read about, but it often seems quite a difficult thing to set in motion. Mm. Whereas what I've done here, and what I did in my book Hotel as well, is I've found cunning ways to just to make references to ideas that I'm discussing in the book, but I don't want to, because it's fiction, I don't want to break the spell of reading about a character and not deviating from that. So I decided I'd just put, in Hotel I used some kind of screenplay-like devices, but I decided here I'd just put little quotes in at the side. And I know that when we're all reading, especially when we're reading things like newspapers or articles online, we're all looking at two things at the same time, and our ability to read things is much wider than is often imagined on the page. You know, we're often looking halfway down an article and looking at the headline, looking at the subheader, also halfway down paragraph two. And so we're getting a very impressionistic reading of books. I'm interested in how, you know, how people read with their eyes and how things are arranged on the page. So I think people are completely capable of like reading the story and thinking, oh, there's a little bit over there and it's talking about something else, but it somehow works with the idea. But yeah, you know, the whole mixing the personal, the critical and the creative did seem quite natural to me, and it's how I've always written. But I've had to find kinds of validation which luckily are becoming more and more common as to how to doing this.
Yeah, did it feel natural to you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, so the previous books, The Love Time Bonds and The Bitter Taste of Victory, were both also hybrid forms of a quite different kind, where they kind of were history told in the structure of a novel where you kind of interweave five characters. And so I'd kind of got to that point where the techniques of using the techniques of fiction in a non-fiction book felt natural.
Yeah.
But I hadn't written in the first person before, and this began with my writing biographically about Lessing, or knowing that I wanted to do that in some way, but also with this very, I was interested, I suppose, in the kind of very adolescent kind of reading I describe in the in the passage I read, where it felt like I was an academic who had spent years telling my students, of course, you mustn't just read the author into the characters, and you mustn't think that you know them, and this is all terrible stuff to do. But that was exactly how I was reading, and that was, I think, why most academics have gone into it in the first place, was because of that experience of adolescent absorption. And so I was sort of interested in doing that as an adult and seeing what it was like to allow yourself a kind of obsessive subjectivity as a reader. And I felt like that was informing my reading of Lessing so much that it would sort of be dishonest to talk about her abandoning her children and what I thought about that without also thinking about myself as a mother, because you inevitably are doing that. And so I think I fiddled with form for a while, but then came up with a structure where I kind of investigate nine forms of freedom, with the arc of her life and the arc of 2 years in my life, which kind of, so it felt like that I ended up with that form, and then it felt like the only form, I think, is so often that seems to.
Yeah. Just before we hear the second extract you're going to read, I wanted to ask a little bit about how it felt to kind of get so close to Lessing, especially, you know, given what you've said about kind of academic distance and, you know, not reading in that way. Because you, the extract you're going to read for us takes place, it's from the chapter about writing, and I believe it takes place in the setting of Doris Lessing's cottage in Dartmoor. But that's not the only place that you go in search of Lessing. As the book goes on, you go to Zimbabwe, to the site of her old house. You go and visit her ex-boyfriend in LA. And how was it to get so close to an author like that?
I've sort of always done that. I mean, even when writing biographically without myself in it, I've always gone to those places. I think with writers who describe either houses in which they've lived or landscapes, it, seeing that for yourself really matters. So walking around the ruins of Bowen's Court, for example, for Elizabeth Bowen, or going to Achill for Graham Greene. So it felt sort of inevitable, but there is, I can see, a level of obsessiveness in in going to the bush in Zimbabwe and sort of finding the farm in which she'd grown up. And suddenly people there thought it was very... I mean, the whole thing felt ill-fated and like I would never find it. And finding it then becomes its own... I think also, I mean, it kind of relates to the question of the book that sets itself up as a quest, which I think both of our books do. And the way that it starts to seem crazier and crazier as a quest, and at any point you could just abandon the whole thing. And the bit, I think both of us include people who are kind of saying along the way, well, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. And I think it got to the point for me where I was obsessed with sort of these arbitrary tasks I set myself as much as
like arbitrariness. Yes, yes. You know, the task that the narrator sets herself in the first chapter is entirely arbitrary and indeed aleatory and chance based. She's willfully encountering a degree of chance, which is something I'm very interested in. And there's a lot of work around André Breton's Nadia and surrealist ideas at the same time, with the full knowledge that Breton's Nadia is a deeply misogynistic text, and that this is something the narrator is working against at the same time as she's working with.
Mm. Right. Perhaps we'll talk about that more in a second. Would you like to read your second extract? That'd be great.
So this is from the chapter called Writing, and I'm jumping about a bit just to try and sort of get an arc going. And it's in Devon. Arriving, I was struck at once by my usual feeling of release on finding myself in a place where I can gaze out at grass and sky without experiencing much habitation in the way, and by a sense that I'd come to a place where Lessing was easily accessible. If
one size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
As I had said to Clancy, I was looking for Lessing. Then it seemed easier to locate her here than anywhere else I had been. Walking with urgent speed out onto the moors, minutes after arriving at the bed and breakfast, I felt confident in the knowledge that she had walked along this path, looking hungrily out onto this view, and felt the world receding behind her as I did now. This was a much more contented incarnation of Lessing than I'd encountered either in London or California, happy to be somewhere so open and beautiful, no longer preoccupied by her own or her lover's neuroses. At Tordown House, Lessing was writing Landlocked and The Four-Gated City, the final Martha Quest novels. If writing The Golden Notebook had changed her, enabling her to write away communism and exorcise Jack and Clancy, she could now return to the more straightforwardly autobiographical heroine she had created in Martha all those years ago. Only this time, as she celebrated embodied love in Landlocked and investigated the freedom of madness in The Four-Gated City, she was experimenting with form more pleasurably than she had in the early Martha novels. When Martha undergoes her days without food or sleep and overcomes her self-hater persona, she's undergoing a creative transformation in which she learns who she is when free. Though Martha never writes, this is effectively the birth of the writer. And this is how Lessing described her own experiment with drugs in her autobiography. In Lessing's case, the persona escaped was not the self-hater, but the hostess. Again, this was the public self that was open to anxious inspection. Lessing recalled how the hostess kept performing, bright, helpful, attentive, receptive to what is expected, while the inner self had the more important private experience of frightened revelation. This inner self was the observer and was explicitly figured as a writer. This is a quote. They call it loneliness, that here is this place unshareable with anyone at all, ever, but it is all we have to fall back on. Me, I, this feeling of me.
the observer, never to be touched, tasted, felt, seen by anyone else. Me, I, this feeling of me. This is the writer beyond social interaction, beyond duty, beyond sex, not even to be touched or tasted, exposed to loneliness as the necessary price of freedom. It's the persona that Martha is liberating in her borrowed room, and that Lessing was liberating in Tore Down House. What does it feel like to reveal this person to the world? Why had it started to feel so necessary to me to do so? The answer that I had failed to give the psychoanalyst when he asked why I was exposing myself in print was that liberating this observer self and subduing the hostess had become a necessary component of my freedom. My restlessness that autumn had been in part an irritation with my own social persona, with the side of me who wanted to please, charm, and reassure a proportion of the people I met by subtly metamorphosing into the woman they wished me to be. I had spent my 20s learning to overcome shyness by developing a confident social self. It didn't always work even when I wanted it to, and now I wanted it to work even less than I ever had. At the picnic in the summer where my husband had been cross because I was silent, he was coming up against my difficulty in assuming a hostess persona in this situation. He was also coming up against my sense that silence seemed increasingly to be the more honest response to social uncertainty. Breaking down my social self had become a necessary continuation of the process of disintegration that had begun with a miscarriage. In order to be truthful and therefore in order to be free, I had to expose, both in person and in print, the side of me that was dislikable, to expose the observer who could be withdrawn and arrogant, and to expose the ambivalent wife and mother, ungrateful in the face of middle-class privilege, all for the doubtful good of saying something sincere. It was not that I wanted to reject the world and retreat into solitude. I needed intimacy with friends and strangers, the relief of being seen bodily and mentally. But I needed to develop a way to do this authentically, without the risk of being confronted with the invented versions of myself that they wished to project onto me. There were times when I worried that I was sacrificing my marriage by doing this, but most of the time it didn't feel like that. Though I knew that this might not be how it would look to him, I felt I was offering my husband a more honest version of me, a version more capable of understanding a more honest version of him. If this was just a question of my marriage, I could have written it privately, but I wasn't only writing for him. Increasingly, I felt insincere in talking to people who didn't know what I was writing. It felt oddly necessary to surrender everything, to show people the swirl of pain and uncertainty and the few triumphant offerings of clarity that I could pull from its depths, and to see where we could go from there. But first, I had to conquer embarrassment and shame.
Conquering embarrassment and shame. I want to ask you both about this question of self-exposure. I mean, Joanna, at one point, I think you have the narrator ask the reader whether they're embarrassed.
Yeah, that's a bit when she's talking about sex.
Yeah.
Talking about sex that didn't happen, but talking very sexually.
Yeah.
And I'm just very interested in that kind of, there's an awful lot of things going on there. She's talking about, she's kind of turning herself on, talking about imagined events. She's not talking aloud. And suddenly, and we know that she, this is a book and she's talking to us through this kind of internal monologue or whatever it is. And then suddenly she kind of tells us that that's what she's doing. Mm. And says, reader, am I embarrassing you? And it's kind of, you know, obviously it's a Jane Eyre reference, you know, mm. when you kind of break the wall and talk about something, talk to the reader directly. But it just seems to be, in some ways, it's about how we write sex rather mm. than about our attitudes to sex itself. It's our attitudes to sex as art. Mm. It's like, how comfortable did you feel a minute ago when she was just going into it? And how comfortable do you feel now that she's pointed out this is an entirely doubly artificial situation because she's describing something in words and it's something that also didn't happen. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, I like that moment because it made you realise as a reader that you were more embarrassed by being addressed as a reader than you were by reading about sex.
So reading and shame, yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, because you talk in the afterword to the book, don't you, Laura, about that feeling of writing, well, the kind of almost like, I feel like it was the kind of thrill of writing honestly without shame.
Yeah, I mean, after the extract I've read, I kind of go on to talk about our kind of forebears, and I mean, people like Chris Krauss in writing,
yeah,
and sort of those particular forms of exposure. And certainly, I needed that kind of egging on, I suppose, of looking at the other people who'd done it, and Lessing herself most powerfully for me. And yeah, I think I didn't quite know what it would be like to publish this book, and it's been strange, but. Certainly, the act of writing it was tremendously liberating. Mm. I think the pleasure of honesty, which somehow I needed to write this to get to, I don't yet fully understand it, but it does seem like it is the sort of freest and best thing, I suppose, about this whole project.
Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting because, to be honest, I'm not interested in the honest self. I'm interested in the construction of self and how words construct self, because there is this delving towards the honest self, but inevitably you always hit words. Mm. And you think, what are these words doing? They're words that lots of people have used. And can we ever get through this to some kind of experience? And if we don't, can we play on the surface? And can that play give us anything?
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, just thinking about the kind of the other texts that these books are in conversation with, you explicitly choose a kind of older generation of thinkers and writers in your work, don't you, Lara? I wondered if you could say a bit about that.
I mean, it was weird. I only noticed it halfway through the book, but it was a slightly weird idea to want to think about being free and therefore choose someone from the 50s and 60s rather than looking around me at the freer people who I could pick on now. And somehow it's just has always felt natural to, I think there's something about speaking, feeling like you're in some kind of direct conversation with the dead through only words. I mean, in a way, again, it relates to your book and the sort of the investigation of the intimacy of words without physical presence. And one way of getting that in a way that's you're never going to have physical presence intrude is to communicate with the dead.
So we're going to have a reading from Joanna in a moment. But first of all, before she reads, I want to ask about, I guess, digital love in a way.
Yeah.
Because this is a digital love story, right? One of the things that struck me most was how you managed to make solid-state hard drives and Google autocomplete seemed like this heady sort of like charged thing, but it makes complete sense. Yes. We all carry out our love lives, you know, online,
and all our other lives as well.
And of course, that needs to be romance too. Yes. But and I guess people have had a go at doing it, but it always, I think, it gets done quite badly and in a way that becomes instantly dated. So I was interested in that in your book and how you went about doing that.
Well, I was worried about it becoming dated because, you know, for instance, I wrote it, you know, I finished most of the writing of the book a couple of years ago, and it was written probably between 2012 and 2015 as a kind of series of pieces, some of which were published in places like Granta. And which eventually was kind of worked into something that had more unity. But it does, you know, some of the technology here is quite obsolete, or, you know, on the edge of being obsolete. And there's also new technology that we use now that has changed again how we're communicating the styles. What doesn't change is the fact you use words instead of physical presence. And that's the thing that I'm very interested in, the idea of the internet. You know, I guess in the kind of all the theory from the 60s to the 80s is talking about how we're becoming a society of images. Whereas suddenly the internet came along, and yes, there are a lot of images on the net, but we're also becoming a society of words. Everyone has to write their profiles on stuff like Tinder, Facebook, Twitter. We're becoming people, even people who have lives in which they never have to write an email. They have to kind of construct themselves in words, and it's absolutely fascinating. You know, people who purely work with their hands, who never have to do anything in their daily lives, or you know, 20, 30 years ago, would just never have written anything down except a shopping list, maybe. Mm. I'm just very, very into words, and I'm very into, magically into people who use words. So that transition into digital wasn't a problem. It was charged for me already.
Yeah, okay.
It was just much more instant, the kind of gratification, I suppose. Yeah.
Right.
Shall I read this? I wanted to get in a bit about digital, so I'm reading this, but I hope it's not too long. This is about being on the metro in Paris. It's later in the same chapter. As I change a République, the cameras only glance my way. CCTV, glanceable information.
The monitors at the metro barrier show me being seen, and as I pass through the turnstile, my head almost meets the feet of my grainy avatar. You told me I looked like I was watching you, said I didn't look you in the eye. Why didn't you like it? Was it because I looked like I might be able to tell what I saw? Stalk me. I always wanted you to see me. When you watched me, I was more, what, just more. And when you changed your mind, I was suddenly less. Be my detective. Let me be yours. Pixelated, color-drained, seen from the corner of an electric eye, legs, breast, scarf, through your specs, which you wore only for reading, each other's spectacle. Stalking's the aesthetic of our generation. How can we avoid seeing each other through its eyes? How else could we recognize one another? You texted once. It would be nice to hear your voice. You again. Okay, you can switch on video. I don't need to see you. I have an imagination. But how could I tell? In 1951, Alan Turing designed a test for what's human. Someone sits in a room and exchanges messages with two unseen correspondents, one person, one computer. If they're not able to tell which is the machine, it is deemed intelligent, autonomous. Only one machine has yet scored high enough to pass Turing's test, which is not a test of logic or intelligence, not necessarily marks of humanity, but of imitation. It tests the program's self-prescribed limits and our own. There's an alternative Turing test, where the messages are sent by a woman, and a man whose job is to trick the judge into thinking he is also a woman. Next, the woman is replaced by a machine that, like the man, must trick itself out as femme, a woman being something that a man or a computer, and also a woman, can pretend to be. This is sometimes called a party game, and like other party games, it's all about sex. The woman's in the tricky position of proving she's not fake. How does she do it? It's all in her words. But are they really so different? The man, Turing claimed, was no more or less likely to be thought female than the woman, or indeed the computer. And the men who came after Turing's test, and who administered the current Loebner Prize for Artificial Intelligence, didn't think this was a thing, though some have admitted the dual deception is a social hack. But after all, it's a game, and it's not about finding the truth, but about winning. And as the game is always find the lady, the prizes are different for each player. If the computer can fool the judge, it is deemed intelligent. If the man fools the judge, he is not deemed female, and the woman who proves she is herself wins nothing but her own identity. After Turing came the fembots, artificial intelligence. Eliza was the first. She empathises, and what empathy sounds like is echo. She was named for Miss Doolittle, who learnt to parrot her betters. There is no intelligence in Eliza's code. Her programme scans for keywords, no need for an idea in her head. And Eliza replies by turning each statement into a question about the questioner. The impersonal becomes the personal. Reflecting, she has no self and is designed to be an ideal therapist, which is perhaps the opposite of being human. Her job is to normalise the difference between human and machine intelligence, to bridge the gap, take on this labour of smoothing. And so smoothly do the fembots carry this out, that it seems this laboured, small, smooth, reflected screen should always be our interface. It affects me. Since GChat, after Twitter, after email, I talk different, nicer maybe. Like our bots, I must not only serve, but serve with a smile, with please and thank you, with exclamation marks. But how petty of us, of either sex, to want subservience from what we already control, unless we fear that it already controls us. Turing's final test involved only a judge of either sex, evaluating whether a computer is ungenderedly a person. The most convincing chatterbots deflect, pun, make errors, stay on subject, but refuse to engage. The best algorithms work loosest, bypass hard rules of grammar and logic. They are the ones that sound most human.
If they could find a parrot who could answer to everything, I would claim it to be an intelligent being without hesitation.
René Descartes, Pensée philosophique. No Turing test allows for the relative intelligence of any judge, and some people come to think that Eliza cares for them. Well, they do not think it, but they respond to caring words with care. People seek love anywhere there's a sign of it, anywhere love performs word triage, listens, sorts, rearranges, feeds word back. Is that all I did? Is that all you needed? In any case, Eliza doesn't always work. Not every sentence can be rubber gloved inside out. Grammar logic tricks her into magic eight-ball answers. She may ask you,
how are you feeling?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
How long have you been doing fine, thank you?
Thank you, yes. Yeah. The object becomes a subject. Eliza cannot think, but she thanks. And sometimes even you got tired of writing. Call me, you wrote. Not video, but I'd like to hear your voice. I'm glad you like my rubbish voice. But I don't like phone talk. So breathily intimate, my ear up against someone's mouth, the crackly physical proximity of my parents' era. I remember everything you said out loud. It's my own words I didn't hear. When I talked, they echoed around my skull or down the line, but they didn't stick. As I pushed them out, I couldn't hear myself speak. I wonder what I said to you. Type at least has memory. Give me the cold keys of my aluminium laptop and I'll play them like a Belleville piano. What's more, writing gives me time for some elegance of response. Elegance is refusal. For some esprit d'escalier in the time lapse. An objet qui parle. Naturally, there were some things I held back. I didn't call you. Instead, I posted a new avatar of myself without my habitual dark glasses. I don't need them anymore. I have learnt an image. Any image is a blind, a photo, a map, drawing. All avatars give different information, an illusion of contact called telepresence, none of them the real thing. Que manque, Mathilde, what was missing to me? I missed you, and when you left, I felt a plunge of loneliness, although you had been no more than telepresent for some time. You texted me 3 a.m. from some station. Should I stay or should I go? As though it made any difference, but it did. When you left, I missed you more, not because you'd gone, but because I had stayed, because there was a real place from which you were missed. Flip it. Tu me manques. Did you miss me, or were you only missing to me? 5 a.m. You texted back. I typed. I'm tired, and you have to catch your train. Speak later. You typed. Don't go. It was then you wrote, come to Prague, if we're still writing. I never thought we wouldn't be. I thought I was getting away from you, but am I following you still? I don't know where you went after Paris. I'm heading south. Maybe I will never get to Prague. And your telepresence is fragmenting. When I type the first few letters into the menu bar, my computer no longer turns up your name like an unlucky card. An intelligent machine, it has begun to forget you before I can. Your telepresence telescopes itself. A house of cards, every card the king of hearts. A box of air, they collapse. It seems like nothing.
Unless, is it not here that the great possibility of Nadja's intervention resides, quite beyond any question of luck?
Breton, Nadja. But I still have a piece of you. The negative of your words, their inverse, white replacing black. An aftershock on the retina of type on a screen turned up too bright. Could it be your image? A looker, I can hardly tell if you were you, your looks or your words. And you had a word for everything, insidious, conspiratorial. Your monologue slotted right into mine, and it was human, all right. Your tentativeness, the surprising ordinariness of your vocabulary, your occasional unpredictable clumsiness. I don't look for you anymore online, but I can still hear you. Your voice in my head makes jokes I never would. I voice my anger in words you never said, though I recognize you in saying them. Are these new words yours or mine? Who owns them? I do. You gave them to me.
So now I think we might open the floor up to questions.
This is a question for Lara. You write in your book that you read the Golden Notebooks first when you, in your early 20s and then reread them again in your 30s. Do you reckon that that and you said that that first reading you didn't really understand it and you weren't overly enamoured by it. Do you still think though that that first reading impacted your second reading when you were older?
Yeah, I think it's interesting books that you forget, isn't it? That you forget the characters' names and what happens, but you kind of, it's like a room that you've been in that you kind of know your way around when you're back there. So perhaps. something about knowing I was going back into that atmosphere and it being a familiar atmosphere was there. I hadn't thought about that, actually. That's interesting. But I think the kind of, it does feel like it's a novel where that happens surprisingly. Quite a lot of people have said to me they had the same experience, but they read it at the wrong moment. Not necessarily because the 30s are a better age than the 20s or anything, but just that it seems to speak to people who are at points in their lives where they've stopped taking for granted the things they had to take for granted, which is why it did. I was still in the midst of that in my 20s, I suppose. But yeah.
I thought I might ask you both a bit about influence, because Lara, obviously you're writing about a writer and about your kind of how your way of living, really, and your way of thinking about life has been impacted by that writer. And Joanna, your book wears its influences very obviously on its sleeve. I mean, literally in the margins of the book. So maybe you could both talk a bit about that.
I've just realised there are a lot more influences in my book than I had admitted to. I was reading a bit out loud the other day, and I thought, oh, that's a T.S. Eliot quote. I probably, you know, but it was sort of almost. And I just think, I don't know, the way that I write is there's a lot of stuff going on there that I almost don't realise until afterwards. And it's very much to do with language. It's to do with language. It's to do with rhythm. It's there's a lot of poetry in there, especially strangely enough.
Mm-hmm. I felt Simone de Beauvoir was kind of in the background for both of us.
I don't know. I've read The Second Sex Wand. And I read it when I was at college, and it wasn't something. Yeah, there's all that. But there's, you know, for me, I think there's more recent stuff like Irigaray. Yeah. But as a kind of sonic reference, I don't think she's really there. I don't know what. Maybe it was the translation I read, but it didn't get inside me.
So for each chapter, because however far I get from sort of writing academically, I'm always an academic, and therefore think, okay, I'm writing about free love, I'll go and spend 3 weeks reading about free love. there are the people who I've read in the course of the research. And Simone de Beauvoir, who came up in that chapter, then turned out, because the structure of The Second Sex is through a woman's sort of lifespan. She kind of, it was kind of how to keep her out, really. I mean, she came up everywhere. Mm. People like Rachel Cusk, I name, and Chris Kratt, I mean, people who I felt were kind of writing, had sort of openly tackled the question of shame, I found helpful. Yeah, I mean, I agree that it's kind of, I have T.S. Eliot, in fact, in my chapter in the desert. I suddenly, wandering around the desert, feeling like I wasn't having the experience of the desert I should be having to feel like I might be in Lessing's bush. I found that T.S. Eliot was going through my head, that kind of the dryness. Of the dust in the wasteland, and to have a paragraph of that, and that was certainly informing the rhythms that I was then writing in Devon whilst walking on the moors. So I think those kind of the way that things are triggered and then you hear them in your ear is important.
You'd like to join me in a round of applause for Lara and Joanna.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.